Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My next guest has been called a real-life, modern-day Atticus Finch, who through his work in redeeming innocent people condemned to death, has sought to redeem the country itself. Desmond Tutu called Bryan Stevenson America's Nelson Mandela. His founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, a nonprofit committed to fighting poverty and challenging racial discrimination in the criminal justice system. He has argued 5 times before the Supreme Court and is the recipient of a MacArthur Genius Award. He's a graduate of Harvard Law School and is on the faculty at New York University School of Law. Bryan Stevenson, welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf. Your book, Just Mercy, is about mass incarceration. That's a tough sell. So what compelled you to write this book?
Well, I'm just persuaded that if people saw what I see on a regular basis, if they understood the things that I've learned over the course of my career, they would really want change. What we're doing in many parts of this nation is simply unacceptable. We're just tolerating abuse and cruelty and injustice in ways that I don't think most people would accept, but there's this information gap. And the book was really an attempt to bridge that gap, to get people closer to the realities of mass incarceration and to, I think, the shame of what's happened to too many people for too long.
Well, you know what I like is that you shake us out of our indifference with a story. And what was this story that got you started on this path?
Well, I do think that narrative is really important. We understand things much more intimately when they're framed by narrative. That certainly would happen to me. I was a law student about to reconcile myself to a career as a lawyer that I knew was not going to be fully affirming, not going to be terribly gratifying when I went to Georgia to work with lawyers representing people on death row. And it was meeting a condemned man who was burdened with chains, handcuffs on his wrists, shackles on his ankles, a chain around his waist, and seeing him respond to just my presence, to just being told that he wasn't at risk of execution any time in the next year, to see how, even in my ignorance, I could have an impact on the quality of this man's life was really quite powerful for me. And then we had this long conversation where we were just talking and discovering that we weren't so different before guards came into the room and treated him pretty roughly, threatened him, and were putting the handcuffs on very tightly. And before they forced him out of the room, this man looked at me and he said, Bryan, don't worry about this. You just come back. And I write in the book about how this man then did something I've never forgotten. He closed his eyes, he threw his head back, and he started to sing. And he sang this old hymn, I'm pressing on the upward way, new heights I'm gaining every day, still praying as I'm onward bound. And then he said, Lord, plant my feet on higher ground. And that man's song changed me. I really knew that I wanted to help condemned people get to higher ground, but mostly I knew that my journey to higher ground was tied to his journey. And it's experiences like that that have absolutely shaped my relationship to the work that I do, to my mission, my purpose, my career. And I think that's what narrative can do. That's what experience can do. It can make you step away from indifference and activate you in ways that I think can be absolutely transformative.
Because you write that you weren't even a lawyer yet. You were just a law student. You go in to meet this man thinking, what in the world am I going to say to him? I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. And he reassured you.
That's right. That's right. And I think that's the real challenge, Nancy. I think that we've got to get proximate to the places and the people who are oftentimes marginalized, who are abused, who are neglected. We think that we can solve problems from a distance, and our solutions don't work because to really be effective, you've got to get proximate. We've been taught, many of us, that if there are bad schools in our community, if there are places where there's violence and despair or drug addiction and dependency, if there are areas where there's abuse and neglect, to stay as far away from those places as possible. I think if we want to change the world, if we want to create more justice, we've actually got to get proximate to the problems. I got proximate to condemned people, and what I learned was that I could actually make a much bigger difference than I thought I could. There's power in proximity, and that man taught me that, and my clients have been teaching me that over the last 30 years.
Well, I was struck by John Stewart's words. He said, discussion of this topic has been white people yelling at each other.
Yeah, I don't think we've done a very good job of even creating a forum for honest discussion. I think we've really been corrupted by what I call the politics of fear and anger. Our politicians have been competing with each other over who can be the toughest on crime, and that has facilitated a discourse that's not even about correction or recovery or rehabilitation or good policy making or good governance. It's just about showing how tough we are. And whenever a society allows itself to be led by fear and anger, it will tolerate abuse. It will tolerate injustice. And we've seen that in the criminal justice system for the last 40 years. I'd like to think that we're turning a corner now, but it's not inevitable. We've got to have people change that narrative of fear and anger and embrace something more redemptive, more hopeful, more integrated into our values and norms and morals as a larger society.
And you make the point that when a mistake is made, we don't like the errors pointed out. We can resist confronting them. And it took 6 years to get a court to overturn Mr. McMillan's conviction.
One of my great frustrations is that our legal system is much more committed to finality than it is to fairness. And you see that in these cases where there's oftentimes obvious evidence of a wrongful conviction, and courts and judges are too frequently looking for reasons to avoid having to correct these mistakes. I don't know why we don't have conviction integrity units in every state, in every prosecutor's office. I don't know why a prosecutor thinks that his or her role is to just maintain the status quo. If there's a problem, we all benefit by correcting that problem, but we don't have that consciousness yet in our criminal justice system, and that's one of the great challenges. Our system is really unreliable right now. I am persuaded that we have more innocent people in jails and prisons today than we have ever had in our history. You cannot go from 300,000 people in jails and prisons in 1972 and 2.3 million people in jails and prisons today and not have a corresponding increase in the number of innocent people wrongly convicted, particularly where I think we still have a system that treats you better if you're rich and guilty than if you're poor and innocent. Wealth, not culpability, is shaping outcomes in too many jurisdictions.
My guest is Brian Stevenson, and he wrote a memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. And in some cases, you have to go to the court of last resort, 60 minutes. You have to go to TV and tell the story on television. You refer to that as the court of last resort.
Well, I do think that there is this barrier between what happens in jails and prisons, what happens in courts, that shields people from understanding what's going on. And transparency and exposure and revelation are key components to how we're going to get reform. In the McMillan case, which I detail, we went to 60 Minutes not because I think it was going to be key to winning the case, but we couldn't create a narrative about Mr. McMillan's wrongful conviction through the local press. We have, I think, in too many places, this kind of entanglement between the media and local law enforcement and local power structures where everybody protects the dominant narrative, which is that we don't make mistakes. We always get the right person. There is no unfairness, inequality, or injustice in our system. And when media becomes complicit in reinforcing that narrative, even when it's not true, you got to shake things up. And there are a handful of entities and institutions and national perspectives that have made shaking things up a little easier. It's in some ways easier today because the Internet has, I think, given us all a little bit more access to create counter-narratives in places where they're desperately needed.
Well, you mentioned, you tell the story, for example, of Walter McMillan and other stories of adults, but you also, there are stories about children, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. One of the real tragedies of the last quarter century, 40 years or more, is what we've done to kids. I mean, we created a narrative in America that there are some children that are not children. They may look like kids, they may act like kids, but we said these are not children. We came up with a new term in the 80s. We said that these are, quote, super predators. We use that rhetoric, that language, to justify horrific policies. There are now 14 states with no minimum age for trying a child as an adult. We've got thousands of young kids in adult jails and prisons where they're at risk of being sexually assaulted and victimized. We've put tens of thousands of kids into adult prisons for decades. And I think we just gave up on a generation of children, mostly black and brown kids, and the consequence of that is really shameful. And I document the pain and the anguish I've seen when 14-year-old boys are put in jails where they're sexually assaulted and abused, or where kids are put in circumstances where they are denied the opportunity to develop as healthy human beings. And some of what's happened in that arena is nothing less than cruel and barbaric.
Well, I appreciate the fact that you give these people a name for us. You tell their stories, because I was born and raised in Georgia, and my dad was like other people of his generation in that culture. As long as we called them colored people, those other people. But when it came to someone he knew,
right,
a friend, he was so compassionate, and he recognized the injustice. But
yeah,
he had to know that person and know them by name. And I think that's what you've done for us.
Well, I think it really is the great power of literature and storytelling. I've seen that dynamic that you described with your father with lots and lots of people. I think we're all much more motivated to stand up for people when they're being unfairly treated, to intervene, to say things that need to be said when we recognize that someone we know, someone we care about, our brothers, our sisters, our neighbors, are being mistreated. It becomes personal to us because they are personal to us. And the one thing I wanted to do was to make the clients, the children I've represented, the adults I've represented, the women I've represented who've gone to prison at such astonishingly high rates. We've had a 640% increase in the number of women being sent to prison in the last 20 years. I wanted all of those people to be known and knowable to readers, because I am persuaded that, like your dad, the more we become aware, the more intimate we become with the community of people who are being victimized, the less acceptable their victimization is. And we need some of that outrage, some of that indignation to create the moral courage, I think, that's going to be required to dismantle mass incarceration and excessive punishment.
My guest is Brian Stevenson. He is a lawyer, an attorney, and he has written a memoir, Just Mercy, A Story of Justice and Redemption. One of the touching stories you tell in your book is a condemned man's last day, and all day long, what do you want for breakfast? And what was his reaction?
You know, it really was challenging. It was an early case that I did, and we'd had such success in blocking executions that when we couldn't block this one, it was very difficult. And I went down to be with him before the execution. This was at the time when they still used the electric chair in Alabama. And he was telling me just how strange the day had been. And when I got back there, it was just a few minutes before the execution, he said, "Brian, it's been so strange. All day long, people have been asking me, what can I do to help?" He said, "When I woke up, they asked me, what do you want for breakfast? At midday, they said, what do you want for lunch? In the evening, they said, what do you want for dinner?" And he said, "They kept coming to me saying, what can I do to help? Can I get you stamps to mail your last letters? Can I get you water? Can I get you coffee? Can we get you the phone to call your friends?" And this man said to me in those last few minutes, he said, "Brian, it's been so strange." He said, "More people have asked me, what can I do to help you in the last 14 hours of my life than they ever did in the first 19 years of my life." And I was holding his hands, thinking, yes, where were they when you were 3 years old and your mom died? Where were they when you were being physically abused? Where were they when you were being assaulted? Where were they when you were drug addicted and homeless? I know where they were when you were accused of this crime. They were lined up to execute you. And that difficulty, that disconnect, was really, really challenging for me to have this man have the hair shaved off his body, then pulled away, strapped into an electric chair, and executed. Was difficult, but it was almost our inability to recognize that more could have been done, should have been done, at a time when it had been meaningful. That was the real hard takeaway for me. And I vowed to him that we would fight harder to get people the help they need, to engage in work that could prevent these tragic outcomes. And it's been the direction of the work we've tried to pursue here at the Equal Justice Initiative.
Well, you're a graduate of Harvard Law School. You could have had a comfortable life like your classmates, I'm sure. What keeps you going?
You know, I really believe that justice is a constant struggle, and that if you don't struggle to fight for the things that are important, you're going to see retreat, you're going to see injustice. And I think seeing what I've seen, knowing what I know, I really couldn't be comfortable doing anything else. I don't feel for me like there's a choice. If you see something that you can fix, if you see someone you can help, and you know that if you don't fix it and if you don't help, there's going to be suffering and pain, you just do it because you have to. It would be hard to live. It would be hard to be at peace without doing that. And I think that's what's happened to me. And I feel in many ways that's been modeled for me by generations of civil rights activists, people who stood when other people told them to sit down, people who spoke when other people told them to be quiet. They have modeled for me the necessity of giving voice to the things that need to be heard. But more than that, they've modeled for me the power that you feel, the energy that you gather when you stand in the place that you think you are required to stand in the name of justice, in the name of what's right. And I often feel that sense of empowerment, that energy, and that makes it much easier for me to do the things that I do, to keep fighting, to do work, than it would be for me to be silent, to stop, to just be quiet.
I'm going to take a break, and when I come back, I'll be talking to my next guest, author Lanny Muehlrath, whose book is The Mindful Vegan. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Lanny Muehlrath blends plant-based nutrition with techniques from mindfulness meditation practice. She's a pioneer in the integration of vegan living and mindfulness. In addition to her latest book, The Mindful Vegan, Lanny Muehlrath has written two previous books, Fit Quickies, 5-Minute Targeted Body-Shaping Workouts, and The Plant-Based Journey. She has served as presenter and consultant for the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. The president of this committee, Dr. Neil Barnard, wrote the foreword to The Mindful Vegan. Lanny Muehlrath, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm very excited to be here. Always a pleasure.
You know, there was a friend of yours that when you came out, you had the title of your book, and the two of you sat down, and she said, "That's a great title." And then she also, you remember what she added? And she said about the title? She said, "It's almost redundant." And I thought, yeah, she's right.
Oh, for The Mindful Vegan.
For the title
yes.
of your book, The Mindful Vegan.
Yeah.
And she said, that's almost redundant.
Yeah. I thought you were referring to Plant-Based Journey. So, yes. Yeah. And because how many books about mindful eating are there out there that really don't address what or who is on your plate and how it got there? And that's part of being mindful, not only the food and how it's feeding your body, but all the ramifications and processes that got it to you.
In fact, it was many years ago now, early 70s, when I started meditation and yoga, my diet started changing. I didn't make a conscious decision, but it was changing. And I remember the day when somebody said, "Oh, then you're a vegetarian." I thought, "Oh, yeah, there's a label for people who eat like I do." But you were a vegetarian, and then you took it a step further, and now are a vegan.
Yes, that's interesting. We have a similar background in that regard because I was teaching yoga through CAVE. Remember that CAVE program here at Chico State, Community Action Volunteers in Education? And I was teaching yoga. And as you know, part of the philosophy around yoga is also the concept of ahimsa, which is nonviolence and a morality around everything we do in our life concerning other sentient beings. So that led to a meditation practice, so that's like 45 years ago now, but it's not the exact process of mindfulness meditation that I teach in the book. I took up another kind of meditation, and I switched to mindfulness practice when I found out that it gave me so much more practical application.
Well, perhaps we should define the term vegan, because a lot of people come across that word and they're not even sure how to pronounce it, much less know who is a vegan?
Yeah, it's embracing a nonviolence and compassion in the way you eat and the way you live, so that you're aware of not looking at animals and other living beings as products, but allowing them to enjoy their life as we all enjoy our lives. Animals all have relationships. They have families. They suffer deep distress when in connection with the animal agriculture industry. So vegan is about not eating animals or using their products in any other way.
There's a great title of a book, and I can't recall the exact words right now, but we love some animals and we wear some animals.
That's Dr. Melanie Joy's book,
yes.
Why We Love Dogs, Wear Cows, and Eat Pigs. And yeah, it even the title begs the question, what is that?
Yeah, I did remember she starts with, we love dogs, but we eat these other animals.
Yeah, and Dr. Melanie Joy wrote some elements for this book, and actually she has a book coming out now too, and recommends The Mindful Vegan to all of her, in her book, it's referenced as a point of self-care and for advocates for kindness for all beings as a practice to help keep us centered.
Yeah, here it is. Dr. Melanie Joy, author of Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. And I mentioned that your foreword is written by someone who's well-known the field of healthy medicine and nutrition, and that's Dr. Neil Barnard. And I really liked his foreword that he wrote. And
good.
I would ask you to read it, except it might sound self-congratulatory, immodest even. So he starts, Dr. Neil Barnard, now in the foreword to your book, The Mindful Vegan. This book is desperately needed and long overdue, because when it comes to food choices nowadays, mindful is just about the last word you might think of. Turn on the television, half the commercials are for burgers, pizza, and snack foods, while the other half are pitching medications to undo the effects of the unhelpful foods we're eating. With most adults weighing more than they would like, and many facing heart disease, diabetes, and other diet-related problems, we're clearly not where we need to be. But what does mindfulness mean? So the title of your book is a short, there's a long subtitle, but the short title, The Mindful Vegan. Mm-hmm. And so you've mentioned that a vegan is somebody who respects animals, doesn't eat them. So a vegan, you might say that we is for somebody who doesn't eat animal products. And then the mindful vegan, and Dr. Barnard raises the question, what does mindfulness mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I want to tag on to this idea of being mindful of what you eat. We also need to look at the implications of animal agriculture on our environment. We know that is the single biggest contributor to environmental degradation is the animal agriculture industry. So there's another point of mindfulness. It's not simply our health, and we know that a plant-based diet is the only diet that's been proven to reverse heart disease. And that we know that also mindfulness then of the animals, of our health, and of planetary well-being is inclusive in that. And I really like to reach out and let everyone know, too, that everyone is welcome to this club. If you're trying to get animal products out of your diet, if you're doing Meatless Monday, if you're aware of, let's have a few veggie meals a week, this process is applicable to everyone. Welcome aboard.
My guest is Lani Muehlrath, and her newest book, her third book, The Mindful Vegan. And Dr. Barnard lists some of the foods that we typically eat. Americans are very fond of hamburgers, pizza, snack food. So we don't even have to think about that. It presents itself. All we have to do is drive down the street, and you can see opportunities for getting burgers, pizza, other snack foods. So we don't have to be mindful. it comes to us. If we're going to be a vegan,
yes,
we have to think about our choices.
Mm. At this point in time, and there are more and more choices of them, there are actually now Amy's, which provides a lot of vegan and vegetarian food. They now have drive-thrus. We need more of those. You can scrutinize menus and find options that will be a fit for simply reducing some of these more harmful foods. But it does take an awakening to that being something you want to do in the first place, and then finding options to follow through with.
Well, I was impressed by your preparation for this book. It was very well organized and presented.
Thank you.
And yet I wonder, how do you even have time to do that, Lanny?
Well,
you're so busy.
This was a full-time job for me for a couple of years. And Greg and I kept up our travels with our wildlife advocacy in Africa and Indonesia.
Greg, meaning your husband.
Yes, my husband Greg and I still teach down at Butte College in kinesiology. So on a limited basis, though, because you just cannot do everything. But Nancy, this process of mindfulness was linchpin for me, as you know from reading The Mindful Vegan. In bringing all of this together, we can know all that we need to know about fitness, which I certainly do with my advanced degree in physical education. I teach kinesiology. I'm skilled in teaching plant-based nutrition. But it wasn't until I really brought the mindfulness piece in that it was linchpin for me for bringing it all together in a way that helped me live with greater ease with this process, and also helped me to, I ended up dropping around 40 or 50 pounds along the way. And it also made it possible for me to navigate this up and down problem that I had with my weight, with food, eating, and my body for probably 3 decades until I took up this process 25 years ago.
Well, part of the preparation was, I don't know how you conducted this survey, maybe online, but more than 1,600 surveys were submitted in preparation for this book.
Yes, yes. And that was through an online process of what people were looking for. What are your sticking points? How can I help you and connect what my experience has been with what you're looking for?
So you didn't just dream up these things that you wanted to say. You went by the kinds of questions real people were dealing with.
Yes, and very connected to my own personal experience. As you know from reading the book, I'm very transparent with my history with this and the process I went through to make some kind of fundamental changes in the way I live my life. And yet I also wanted supported by what's going to work for you, the people that have been working with me for a while, what's best to put in this process for you.
Well, what things did you learn when you looked at these surveys?
That people really needed help with compulsive eating, stress eating, mindless snacking, anxiety, stress reduction, stress management, and just plain getting a healthier, happier relationship with food, with eating, and with their bodies. And that was all fundamental to my experience, so I knew right where to go.
Well, I'm sometimes surprised at what people don't know, because I have a friend, he's an intelligent person, he has a degree from Harvard, and I mentioned eating seasonally, which I do.
Yes,
it's
I know.
In the farmer's
I'm so
market.
Good at that.
And he said, what do you mean by that?
Put seasoning on or something.
But I was surprised that this, something that seems so obvious to me, is not obvious to other people.
And that's really important to say. I know that sometimes when I'm teaching about whole foods, plant-based nutrition, and you'll say, well, consume more leafy greens. And people go, what's a leafy green? And we just have to step back and be present with that person with wherever they are in their journey. And how can we answer the question?
In fact, I used to, when I taught yoga to college students, I kind of borrowed a page from Sesame Street where they featured the letter B. And so I would feature at the end of class. The first day I would say, just how many leafy greens can you name? And most of them could name spinach. And that was about the end of their list. So each week I would feature another leafy green.
See, that's teaching to the moment. Very good.
And I know an older lady, an aunt, my husband's aunt, who said, she was in the grocery store, and I forgot which leafy green it was, but she's an adult, been cooking for years. But she said, well, what would you do with that? How would you cook that?
Yeah, there you go. There's another question.
And your book is full of really practical advice. And you include recipes at the back of your book. Mm-hmm. And one in particular that I latched onto because I happen to like kitchery.
Oh.
And I think most people say, what is she saying?
Yeah,
kitchery. Tell us what kitchery
is. Well, years ago, I actually traveled to India several times in meditation studies. And at the ashrams, they teach serve wonderful Indian food, which I fell in love with from the start. And khichdi is simply a lentil-based meal that has all those wonderful central Indian spices like coriander and cumin and all
ginger,
that.
Ginger, I love ginger.
Yeah, and ginger in it. So it's a very perfect for the fall, by the way. Hearty meal, any time of the day, just serve it over rice or by itself. And, you know, it just satisfies, just gets you a fire in your belly. So I really wanted to include a few recipes. It's not a cookbook, but part of the energy behind the Mindful Vegan is restoring the pure joy of eating. And I think even along lines of with vegetarian and vegan eating and plant-based nutrition, there can be too much of a sense of drawing in and cutting out. And I really embrace anything within that realm. Magnify the whole plant foods in your diet, but let's also really enjoy our food. Let's be mindful and present with this celebration of eating.
In fact, it's almost embarrassing for me sometimes when people see me eat because I eat a lot. I mean, it's vegetables, but I eat a lot for my size, I think, in most people's eyes.
Well, those looks plant like foods take up a lot of space. There's so much fiber there that
and I enjoy it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good for you. I love people who love eating. So that's
I'm
good.
One of those people. Okay. So you mentioned your own story. And you're fairly tall, so to lose 40 or 50 pounds, though, is still a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you go about doing that?
Well, and as you know, in my opening chapter when I talk about my watershed moment, and when I started mindfulness meditation practice, I went to a 30-day retreat that was a silent retreat. Now, this is where you don't talk, you don't read, you simply spend time, you, your thoughts, and your body for a period of days. And as you can imagine, that's quite revealing. You start to realize that this wild meanderings of our mind, they're actually always going on. And we should talk a little bit about wandering mind, too, when we come up. But we're not aware of it until we sit down and try to just be present with it. And it was about day four of that retreat that I sat down to a meal in silence, which was the tradition of the retreat. And I felt this tremendous tension in my body. I had a knot in my throat and my gut. And I thought, I have had so much tension around food and eating probably for a long time. And how sad is that? And how enlightening is that for maybe this will get to the roots of my problem, not psychologically, but just by being present with that experience. So from that moment on, I decided to eat mindfully, which is not only considering what's on your plate, but being connected with your natural hunger and fullness signals. And this process helps you recover those. And I gave up dieting and counting and weighing and measuring as I had known it for so long and just focused on whole plant foods and enjoying what I ate. And, you know, what a tremendous change was that.
My guest is Lani Muehlrath, and her newest book, third book, The Mindful Vegan, A 30-Day Plan for Finding Health, Balance, Peace, and Happiness. That's a pretty ambitious subtitle, Lani. A 30-Day Plan for Finding Health, Balance, Peace, and happiness.
I put it together as a 30-day plan because, Nancy, I did not want this to be a book about mindfulness practice and eating that people thought, oh, this is great. Maybe I'll do that someday and put it down. I wanted to get people started from the start and see what this practice might hold for them. You know, there are many paths to awakening. And my advice is if you have something that connects you with the present and makes you feel more grounded and living with more ease, then by all means continue or pick that practice up again. But if you're looking for something new and you want to try it, I put it together in a very simple fashion. As you know, day one, I give clear instructions, 1 minute. Day two,
1 minute.
Two minutes.
Don't tell somebody, go off on a 30-day silent retreat.
No.
You
no.
say, sit down for a minute.
Yes. Well, I know what our lives are like, and I want this to be accessible and doable to people. And I put it together in such clear, instructive fashion. And by the way, along the lines of let's get going now, I've just uploaded 30 audios, which are downloadable for free from my site. It tells you where to go and resources in the book, another tool for getting people started and getting going.
In fact, your book is, rather than being divided into chapters, is divided into days.
Yes, there we go.
Day one, day two. And I thought you did a good job with the titles of these.
Are they intriguing?
Chapters. They are intriguing.
Okay, good.
The titles of your what people might consider chapters. And you mentioned that you start out day one, you just a minute's meditation. And I think people say, oh, okay, I can do that.
Yeah.
I can't sit for an hour,
yeah,
but I can do a minute. Mm-hmm. That's doable.
Yeah, and all that's doing is let's figure out how do you sit down? And by the way, many people think that mindfulness meditation means you're supposed to be seated cross-legged on a cushion in a special room. Well, that's because many of the cultures from which mindfulness is derived is from people who sit on the floor on cushions. Well, you can sit in a chair. You can even do this lying down. I just want you to get going in a position that is comfortable and sustainable for you.
In fact, Inlow Medical Center offers an 8-week program in mindfulness meditation.
Mm-hmm. I have seen that. It's all over the country now. In hundreds, thousands of hospitals around the world now is mindfulness-based stress management and stress protection. And as you know, this is so robustly researched. I have all the research in here about that, about with binge eating, with addictions, with stress management, with psoriasis, with anxiety. It touches every one of these realms because they have a fundamental inspiration for these problems.
I happened to, years ago, take this class, this 8-week meditation.
Oh.
So a lot of what Jon Kabat-Zinn is a pioneer in mindfulness meditation, and a lot of what he says, of course, are echoed in your book.
Yes, I haven't quoted
but
in the book.
It's based on your experience, and I'd like to remind listeners that they don't have to believe a word you say. All they have to do is try it. And I
see
think
what it holds for you. Yeah.
They don't have to take somebody else's word for it. If they really try what you suggest, they might discover little things like you were saying one day that you forgot chocolate was in the house. Lanny.
Is that breakthrough or what? And as I say, it's toward the beginning of the book because it just was something that told me what this practice was doing for me. I was in the kitchen and I was preparing dinner and I reached in for a jar of rice and I noticed this package there, and I looked and I saw it was a package of chocolate, and it had been there about 2 weeks. Now, for me, I never forget about chocolate in the house. So this, to me, said there is some reason that I'm just not navigating to this chocolate all the time. It was like such a revelation for me, and I was so happy. It gave me so much promise for this technique, because those of us who struggle with that kind of thing understand that not having that happen in the way that it used to is a huge relief.
And it gave you hope.
Gave me hope that maybe, I'm onto something here. So, yeah.
Because what you propose, and this is why I mentioned the tasty recipes, people discover, I didn't even know I like lentils cooked this way. It's a way of having abundance in your life and not denying yourself.
Thank you. Oh, I love that. That's the whole energy behind this, is embracing and not feeling like it's something that's limiting, but you're opening yourself to this new way of living, this new ease of living with compassion. And by the way, somewhere along the line, it'd probably be good to do what my official definition of mindfulness is, because I think it really might help the listeners. Would this be a good time for that?
Yeah, because Dr. Barnard says, what is mindfulness?
That's right. That's perfect. Yeah. You just said that. Well, just as a platform to help people understand what's coming off here, mindfulness is a specific form of mental training, and it's a particular kind of awareness that you bring to your daily activities. Now, together, this leads to reductions in reactivity and the cultivation of positive brain states. And I'd like to just briefly elaborate on those two. Reductions in reactivity. How much of our day is spent in reaction to something, whether it's to a person, to a place, to a thing, whether it's anger or finding ourselves up to our wrists in a box of whatever before we know it. And these are all things that cause human misery, this reactivity. And the other part of that is cultivation of positive brain states. We have with us endogenous compassion, kindness, equanimity, love. We've just managed to heap it over with our active lives, our busy minds. So when you do these practices, it's an opportunity to, excavate those things or unobscure them.
I think of it as you were saying that, because I often think of it as an onion, and we peel away these layers of stress and compulsion. And if we peel away all those layers, there is the real person there.
Yeah, and it's always there. And I think it's important for people to understand, too, that mindfulness practice, I'm sure many people listening have tried some kind of meditation, and they say, I just can't do this. My mind doesn't quiet down. Well, you don't need to quiet your mind down. The whole idea is it's your mind's job to do all these things, but you learn how to expand that space between stimulus and response, as Viktor Frankl said, and open up the space so that you can live more skillfully and with greater ease.
Now, you mentioned quoting Viktor Frankl. That's another thing I enjoy at the start of your chapter slash days. The quotes, for example, William James uses the Latin term compo sui, master oneself, in his quote. And you're saying that we don't have to try to force ourselves to master our minds.
No, it's just getting some degree of mastery over your habits of thinking. That's not getting a lockdown on your mind. That's finding out there's a little bit of space. And we all know it. We all know there's that lag moment, and we can tune into that more so that you can then respond with more equanimity and with compassion, and for yourself, too. We're so quick to judge ourselves and reinforce negative thoughts and behaviors that way. But another thing that's very exciting about these endogenous qualities, I don't know if you got to day 30 in the Dean Ornish contribution there, but I interviewed Dr. Dean Ornish, which many people may recognize from the UCSF Heart Disease Prevention and Reversal Program, which is, by the way, covered by Medicare. But I had a wonderful interview with him in his office in Sausalito, and our interview was like the foundation of day 30, because what he said was so rich. He's been meditating since 1975. Like when you and I took it up, he was there too. And he said, first,
Swami Satchidananda.
And
that was his guru.
Yes. And you've probably read his
book. Probably saved him. He might not have become a doctor even. He really got desperate.
He gave me all his books and gave me some background. But he said, I'm so glad you're teaching a book about meditation, because this is so needed. And I'm so glad that you're telling people that this is something that is natural to us, this equanimity and peace and kindness. It's not something you reach out of yourselves like another form of Valium that you go get. It's simply uncovering what is already there. And I'm thrilled about his contribution there. Very nice.
My guest is health and wellness educator Lani Muehlrath. She's also an author, and her third book is The Mindful Vegan, a 30-day plan for finding health, balance, peace, and happiness. And one of the quotes in your book, you say, you don't seek peace of mind, you create conditions in which peace of mind can take place. That kind of takes the burden off. Oh, this is not something I've got to do. I'm just going to let it happen.
That's a perfect tag on to what we were just talking about. It's there. Let's just find it and uncover it. And yeah.
We're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'll continue my conversation with my guest, Lani Muehlrath, author of The Mindful Vegan. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest is health and wellness teacher, author, speaker, and TV host Lani Muehlrath, known for her expertise in plant-based mindful living. Well, when you become a vegan or vegetarian, there's this interaction. You still have to interact with other people who don't share your views.
Yes,
and I'm reluctant to, I don't know how to say this tactfully, but there are people, say somebody used to smoke and they become a non-smoker and then they're just militant about nobody else should smoke. And sometimes I think there are people who give the impression that they're a better person, this holier than thou, and all of you meat eaters are sinners. And that's
not your way. Yeah, it isn't. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I address that in the book. There's two ways to look at that. One way is there are people who are a little bit evangelistic about this approach. But also, oftentimes by someone just being present as a vegan or vegetarian, it is perceived as judgmental, whether it may not be or not, because I think it reaches into that part of everyone where they may, you know, yes, I love animals, but I eat them, so maybe there's a little dichotomy there. But if you present that conflict to them, then you become the messenger they want to shoot. So I actually address this directly in the book because mindfulness practice also helps ease your way at navigating these conversations. And rather than memorizing a speech and how to be against what might be a difficult situation, I recommend, and this is what Dr. Melanie Joy is so excited about my book too, rather be confident, be consistent in what you do, and be present with the person that you are with. You can't control their reactivity to you, but you can navigate your own reactivity and find love and connection and be compassionate with whoever is across the table from you.
Well, I was glancing down your table of contents, and I got to day 20, or chapter, if you want to view it that way, 21, and I saw that the title of it was Activism.
Attractivism.
I know, but I saw, in glancing,
yes,
I saw
said activism,
activism.
Yeah.
And I thought that was clever on your part, because then I'm reading the book, and I see, oh, it's not activism, it's attractivism.
Yeah.
And in that chapter, you introduce us to Angel.
Mm-hmm.
Who was Angel?
Angel is a beautiful golden cow who was rescued from a farm in the Petaluma area that had been shut down. And she was kind of being hung on to until the last minute she could be sold for slaughter. And, you know, the farmer kind of had her in the back bin. And Karenna, who happened to be driving through the area, stopped the farm and eventually, over the period of a couple of visits, was able to adopt Angel, and she's now living happily in Rancho Compasión in Casio, which is a friend of mine's animal sanctuary. But I called it attractivism. I did coin the word, and I understand, you know, we see words as chunks of things. As a teacher, I know that. But it combined activism and attraction, and this ties in perfectly with everything we've said. If you are confident and kind and compassionate and understanding of people around you, this is a better way to draw them to uncovering those things in themselves, and it's a better way to reach people. And she demonstrated that. She reached out to this farmer, and she switched her language, actually. Instead of rescue, we're going to rescue this animal, which kind of was off-putting.
Oh, yeah.
She
like,
started.
Oh, you're accusing
exactly.
me
it's
of
very, yeah.
doing harm to this animal that the animal
yeah.
needs rescuing
yeah.
from me,
yeah.
the farmer.
Instead, she told a story about her growing up, how her father was a hunter, and that she would like to adopt this animal. And so she established a relationship. This is what we were talking about earlier. Connect with the other human being. Instead of seeing them as an opinion, is it possible for us to connect with them on a human level and help to unobscure these qualities within them.
I saw a picture of you and Angel. She's
oh,
a
yeah.
lovely animal.
Yeah, I think it's on the head of my profile page right now.
You also have a story of a woman named Catherine, Free Fall to Freedom.
Yeah, she was one of those people who exemplified stress eating every day in the afternoon. And maybe people can relate. Many of us can. 3 to 4 in the afternoon. She was a busy nursing professor. She's kind of head of the department, had a big family to manage. And she found that every day around that time, she would just get pulled to the vending machine. And it was bags of pretzels to get her through. And so it had become a stress reducer, and it had become a habituated reaction for her too. So we dissolve this through mindfulness practices, through making sure she ate enough earlier in the day. She also found she was just doing too strict of dieting and control over her food. And once you let that relax, you open the door to these other avenues that allow you to be more present. So she was able to navigate the sensations that she was used to of reaching for something, and that fell apart for her. So she wasn't
I think
doing
some
that.
People who have never had this problem that you're describing are quick to judge. They see somebody who's overweight and say, oh, that person just has no self-discipline.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think it's the other way around. When you describe people like Catherine or
tremendous
Sarah,
self-discipline.
They have tremendous self-discipline.
Yeah. Yeah, and I believe that some of us are more sensitive to not eating enough food on time when we're hungry. Some people can eat really recklessly. We all know them. They can eat a bag of M&Ms for lunch, have a big dinner, no breakfast, and they're thin as a rail. Well, that's their genetic component. Some of us are very sensitive to not eating quality food and not eating when we're hungry. And then we get this stored hunger, and then we just want to eat sweets all afternoon or evening. And it's simply a matter of being mindful of what is my body needing. It needs fuel right now. But there's so much fear of that with the diet industry. The diet industry says, clamp down, lose 20 pounds yesterday. It doesn't work.
Well, I would, going back to the definition of a vegan, the recipes that you include, I kind of hate to say what's not in a vegan's diet, but people will want to know what you
whatever
don't eat.
Because
I
understand.
Like to, like you say, emphasize what you can eat.
Yeah.
Explore all these leafy greens and lentil stew and things that you might not try, but just for their benefit.
Sure, that's a good idea. It's anything with an animal product. So that means meat, chicken, fish, dairy products, and eggs, which for many people comprises a large part of their diet, which, as we know, statistically, a large component of leads to accelerated rates of heart disease and cancer. And there's no fiber in those foods, by the way.
And so, you make the point in your book, one of the, cut out meat and improve your mood.
Oh, yeah. There is research studies that correlate three to five servings of fruits and vegetables a day correlates with a happier mood. And not just because people are happy that they are eating more foods like that, like, oh, I'm doing a good job. It's actually correlated in the research. So I'm glad you pointed that out, because then all the questions come up about protein and calcium and our four food lobbies kind of nutrition approach. And there are many resources out there that tell us that actually broccoli and other greens have more protein per calorie than does beef. Calcium comes in leafy greens and almonds and sesame seeds and black beans. And there are plant alternatives or replacements to this. And if we can live in a way that is delicious food without causing harm, why not?
Well, it's been delightful talking to you about this book, The Mindful Vegan. My guest is Lani Muehlrath. Thank you for joining
us for this conversation.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.